We live in a day of great religious compromise. Those seeking to rob us of our heritage and our faith are constantly telling us to forget the past. They argue that the past has nothing to offer but hurt and division. If we are to go forward, they tell us that we need to leave down our banners and we need to forget the past. However, when we come into the book of Deuteronomy, we have a very different picture. Preparing the children of Israel for entering into the promised land, we find the Lord telling them in this one book 14 times over to remember. They were not only to remember how the Lord had brought them out of Egypt, but they were to remember how that he had swallowed up the armies of Pharaoh in the waters of the Red Sea. More than that, they were to remember that coming into the wilderness, how the Lord had miraculously provided food for them and had brought them into the promised land. As if to emphasize that, we find them also telling them in that book 9 times over not to forget. And forgetting, he said in the chapter 8 and the verse 19, ye shall surely perish. And if they were to successfully occupy this new land, then there needed to be a remembering of the past. You see, to forget the past is not only foolish, but it is fatal. It brings nothing but destruction. Indeed, forgetting the miracle of the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, it wasn't long until the disciples began to doubt. Realizing that, the psalmist said in Psalm 77, and in the verses 11 and 12, I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. And following in the footsteps of the psalmist this evening, I don't want to preach. I simply want to meditate or remember one of the wonders which the Lord did. How that in 1688 and 1689, he delivered the maiden city of Londonderry. And in delivering that city, he delivered an entire nation and gave to us the liberty that we enjoy this evening. In so doing, I want to take you back in time. I want to take you back to 1641. On Saturday, the 23rd of October, commenced one of the darkest and most savage periods in our history. On that day, a rebellion led by Sir Phelim O'Neill swept with all the suddenness and fury of a tornado across the land, intending not only to overthrow British rule, but to establish Romanism. Protestants were cruelly butchered. Mothers were forced to watch as their children's brains were dashed out against walls. Others had their eyes gouged out, their hands cut off. Many were buried alive. At Loch Gall, 300 Protestant men, women, boys and girls were stripped naked and they were driven into the local Presbyterian church. The doors of the church were locked. And over the next number of days, they were brought out one by one. Many of the women were broiled on hot gridirons. Many of the men were hung twice, 3 times and then revived. They were butchered in the most cruel manner. At Portadown, over 1,000 Protestants were driven off the broken down bridge. Elizabeth Price was forced to watch as her 5 children, along with a further 110 Protestants from Armagh, were driven into the cold and icy waters of the Bann. Christian Stronhaugh testifies that those that were able to swim were either held down by poles or they were shot by muskets. Over 1,000 Protestants were drowned there at the bridge. A priest by the name of Mahoney boasted that in 4 years that they killed 150,000 Protestants. Now that number may be a little high, but at the end of that time, the whole Protestant populations of many areas were almost completely exterminated. By May 1642, there was hardly a Protestant left in the whole of County Fermanagh. With memories of these awful atrocities still fresh in the minds of the Protestant population, They were greatly stirred in December 1688 with the discovery of a letter which was known as the Cumber Letter. Whether that letter was fake or genuine, we don't know till this very day. That letter was addressed to the Protestant Earl of Mount Alexander, and it was dated the 3rd of December, 1688. And we'll let you hear the letter.
To the Protestant Earl of Mount Alexander, 3rd of December, 1688. Good my lord, I have written to let you know that all our Irish men through Ireland is sworn that on the 9th day of this month they are to fall on and kill and murder man, wife and child. And I desire your lordship to take care of yourself and all others that are judged by our men to be heads. For whosoever of them can kill any of you, they are to have a captain's place. So my desire to your honour is to look to yourself and to give other noblemen warning, and go not out either day or night without a good guard with you, and let no Irish man come near you, whatsoever he be. So this is all from him who is your father's friend, and will be, though I dare not be known as yet for fear of my life.
News of that letter spreading across the province, warning of another general massacre, such as 1641, there was widespread panic. News of the letter reached the maiden city of Londonderry on the 6th of December, or according to the revised calendar, the 18th of December. Its inhabitants beholding at the same time a regiment of Tyrconnell's newly Romanized army approaching the city, they feared the worst. Fearing the general massacre had begun, panic quickly spread through the streets. While the city councillors debated and the bishop of the city urged surrender, a number of young apprentices, probably just in their late teens, took matters into their own hands. And I'm sure you'll not begrudge me a moment or two this evening just to set before you the names of those 13 apprentices. The first name in that list is Henry Campsey. Henry Campsey was later wounded during the time of the siege. The bishop, the Church of Ireland bishop of the city at the time, was Bishop Hopkins. He urged the people in the city to surrender. Alexander Irwin, one day hearing him urging the surrender, he approached him. He said to him, "My lord, your doctrines are very good, but we cannot hear you out." He was not being disrespectful, but he was simply saying that the time for talking was now over. It was now time for action. Rushing to the guardroom, these apprentices seized the keys of the city, and running the closed ferry key gate in the face of Lord Antrim's Redshanks. When the enemy showed no disposition to retire, James Morrison, later became captain of the guard, cried out, "Bring a big gun away." And immediately the cry rose again, "No surrender, no surrender, no surrender." But I have to say this evening that the city at this particular time was not ready to withstand a siege. I say that tonight for a number of reasons. Firstly, because while the city was walled around, there were no ditches in front of the walls or in front of the gates. For many years, the people just took their rubbish and they threw it out over the walls of the city. And as a consequence, ground in many places outside the wall actually higher than the walls themselves. You can see even from this picture, the walls are in a sorry state of disrepair. The second reason they weren't ready for a siege was that on the other side of the River Foyle, you have an area known as Governor's Keep. Of course, it is a Republican den today, and it was occupied by James's forces back then. You can see from the picture here at the forefront that it was much higher than the actual city itself. And as such, James was able to put his guns up here, and he was able to rain mortars down into the city day after day and night after night. Also, there were no provisions within the city. But the greatest of all dangers was that some of the inhabitants were in league with the enemy. A secret, our enemy within is far more dangerous than an army without. The governor at the time was a man by the name of Colonel Lundy. And instead of defending his inhabitants of the city, he urged them to surrender to King James. When the men of Enniskillen came to him seeking help, he urged them also to surrender and to submit to the authority of James. Also, as a soldier, Colonel Lundy was incompetent. On one occasion, he led his forces out of the city, and he took them up the Foyle, and he took them up past Strabane to a little place known as Claddagh. And he went there to try and stop James's forces crossing over. But he was defeated, and he was quickly driven back into the city. Eventually, two English regiments arrived in Lough Foyle to relieve the city. Now, they consisted of 1,600 men. Their journey to the city was not an easy journey. They had been caught in many storms. Their biscuits were so moldy that they couldn't eat them. They had no fresh water. They had been forced to drink seawater and even their own urine. And as a result, many of them had died, and many of the rest of them were sick. And yet, despite their weakness, these men were ready to come and to relieve the city. However, Colonel Lundy persuaded them to pull up anchor and to turn round and to go back again to England. On the evening of the 17th of April, 1689, it was discovered that the gates of the city had been left open and the keys mysteriously disappeared. The next day, King James himself arrived at the city and he demanded admission into the city. Instead of giving the order to open fire, Colonel Lundy once again urged the inhabitants to surrender and to submit to James. More than that, he had locked out of the city the brave cavalry of Captain Adam Murray. And perhaps I could just take a moment this evening to say that as far as I'm concerned, the great hero of the Siege of Derry was Captain Adam Murray. Now, that's not just because he had a great name. I can't really claim that I'm related to him, but he was a great soldier and a great defender of the city. Captain Adam Murray came from just outside the city. In fact, his house is still there to this very day. If you go to Claddagh and head towards the city, it's just outside Claddagh a little bit, and it's known as Ling's House. I know that some years back it was bought over by the apprentice boys to turn into a museum. I don't know who owns it today, but I do know that it is in a sad state of disrepair. And you know, if it had not been for Captain Adam Murray and Captain Baker that day, the city would probably have surrendered. But Captain Adam Murray managed to get into the city. And getting into the city, he called the men to arms. And immediately, the cry rose again throughout the city, "No surrender, no surrender." It was followed then by a loud bang. And one of James's officers standing by his side fell down dead. Shocked by the defiance of the city, King James retreated in the most unkingly manner. Lundy now knew that his time was running out. He feared that the inhabitants would take him and they would charge him with treason and they would hang him as a traitor. And so darkness coming down, he climbed over the walls of the city and he went back to England. He was arrested in London and he was put into the Tower of London on suspicion of treasonable practices against His Majesty's government. He was later released and was sent to help in the defense of Gibraltar. Of course, he proved as much good over there as he did in the Maiden City. And he got himself captured, and he languished there in prison for some time. He was eventually my exchange for other prisoners, and Lundy wasn't burned, but Lundy eventually died in Scotland in 1717 in obscurity. Of course, his effigy has been burned since 1789 with the words, "The end of all traitors." With Lundy's desertion, the city had a problem. It needed a new governor. So nominations were set up for a new governor. The nominations were Major Henry Baker, Major Mitchelburn, Lieutenant General Johnson. Major Henry Baker was then appointed as the new governor of the city. He asked for the Reverend George Walker to be appointed as his assistant to help administer the stores within the city. Now, sometimes you'll hear people talking about Governor Walker. Walker was never governor of the city. He was just a helper to Governor Baker. How good he was at that job, I'm not sure. But I know that he was charged with keeping some of the stores for himself, although he was later cleared of those charges. The Reverend Walker died at the Battle of the Boyne, and when someone went to King William and told him that the Reverend Walker had been killed, William's only response was, "Well, I don't know what he was doing here anyway." To me, Walker is not the hero, but Captain Adam Murray would be the great hero of the siege. Although the traitor had been expelled, the city was not yet out of danger. As you can see from the picture that will come up in a moment, the city itself was not really that big. It was only about 1 mile in circumference. It was originally built to house just a few thousand people. The population in 1706 was 2,848. During the siege, Walker tells us that that number actually swelled to around 30,000. Now, if you know the Maiden City of Londonderry, you'll know that it's not really that big. It's not very far from Shipley Gate to Bishop Gate, or from Butcher Gate to Ferry Quay Gate. And 30,000 in the city, they must almost have been standing shoulder to shoulder. Out of that 30,000, only 7,500 were able-bodied men. They were quickly organized into 8 regiments, and each regiment was given a particular part of the walls of the city to defend. In contrast, the enemy outside numbered 20,000. The brave defenders were outnumbered 3-1. Sometimes people imagine that at the time of the siege, they just went in, locked the gates, and that they just remained there until the city was relieved. That's far from the truth. The brave defenders were defenders. But more than that, they took the battle out against the enemy again and again. They took the attack out. You can see the boom here that was placed across the River Foy. On the 21st of April, they find James's forces sought to take there in the blue the little village of Pennyburn. Seeing the enemy there, Captain Adam Murray led a force of 500 musketeers out against them. In the pursuing battle, the brave defenders lost 3 officers and less than a dozen men. The Irish lost over 200. Most significantly that day, Captain Adam Murray engaged Lieutenant General Maumont in hand-to-hand conflict, and he slew him. Maumont was one of James's best officers. That night they went back to the city, not only victorious, but they went back with vital supplies of food and ammunition. James then ordered up big guns from Dublin. You can see they were brought to the area marked there in the green. And that area, of course, is known as the Bog Side. And of course, it was known as the Bog Side for a simple reason. And that was because it was a bog. And every time they fired the big guns, the guns literally disappeared out of sight. And it took them days digging the guns out and getting them ready again for the battle. In another battle, the Irish attempted to take Windy Mill Hill, marked just there with the red. It's about 500 yards south of Bishop Gate. They lost that day, the Irish, 200 men. A further 500 of their men were wounded. And over the next few days, 300 of that 500 also died. Again, the brave defenders lost less than a half a dozen men. You see, they didn't just sit in the city. My, they went out. They took the battle out to the enemy. Of course, there's a lesson in that for Christians as well. Because, you know, we should not be just sitting back defending what we have got. We should be taking the battle out. We should be pressing the battle to the very gates of hell. We should be going where the lost are. We should be seeking to win them for the Lord Jesus Christ. Never be content in defending what you've got. We should be, as believers, seeking to take more and more ground for the Lord. However, while the besiegers won many of those skirmishes, the city remained under continual assault. From the 3rd to the 8th of June, 159 bombs fell on the city. On 36 fell in the night of the 4th of June, killing several men. One fell in the house of David Cairns, one of the brave apprentices, killing two men. On the 28th of June, the enemy then led an attack against Bishop Gate. They managed to get right into the workings of the gate. However, the brave defenders, seeing what happened, they ran and they drove the enemy out. But Baker was wounded in that battle. And within a few days, Governor Baker died. With his death, then Colonel Mitchelburn was appointed then as the new governor of the city. Of course, the crimson flag, which is the flag of the apprentice boys. It was also the crimson flag which was flown throughout the siege, was known as Mitchelburn's bloody flag. Mitchelburn died in 1721, and he was buried beside Captain Adam Murray in Glendermot Churchyard. If you're going up into the city from the Dungiven side, as you go up into the city, that graveyard is there on your left. And if you have a little time to spare sometime, you should go in and look out the graves of these men who fought valiantly and for the defence of the city. However, the attacks of the enemy, failing to break the morale of the brave defenders, rose up. James, as commander-in-chief, then turned to more heinous methods. On the 30th of June, he sent a declaration to the commanders within the city to the effect that if they did not surrender by 6 p.m. on the 1st of July, that all the remaining Protestants in the countryside would be gathered together, and they'd be driven beneath the walls of the city. They'd be left there in the cold and rain to starve to death or to be killed in the crossfire. The first 200 were driven beneath the walls on the 2nd of July. The brave defenders, imagining that it was the enemy, they opened fire. But praise be unto God, on that one occasion, their aim proved to be inaccurate. Over the next number of days and weeks, more and more Protestants from Coleraine, Limavady, Garva, Strabane, Donegal, were driven beneath the walls of the city. Until someone tells us that they actually numbered around 7,000. What made the sight even more pitiful was that many of the brave defenders sitting or standing at their post on the walls looking down. They were looking down into the starving faces of their own fathers and mothers. Sometimes into the face of their own grandparents. Sometimes they were looking into the starving eyes of their own children. But they still refused to surrender. Then the order was given. And a large set of gallows were built on the walls of the city. 20 Irish prisoners were chosen out, and they were told to prepare to die. Of course, while they were willing to die for King James, they didn't want to die the death of a criminal. They didn't want to be hung. And so they asked permission, could they write to Rosen, asking Rosen to let those beneath the walls go home. Permission was granted for that letter to be written. And we'll hear the letter.
My Lord, upon the hard dealing the protected, as well as other Protestants, have met withal in being sent under the walls. You have so incensed the governor and others of this garrison that we are all condemned by a court-martial to die tomorrow, unless those poor people be withdrawn. We have made application to Marshal General de Russen, but having received no answer, we make it our request to you, as knowing you are a person that does not delight in shedding innocent blood, that you will represent our condition to the Marshal General. The lives of 20 prisoners lie at stake, and therefore require your diligence and care. We are willing to die with our swords in our hands for His Majesty, but to suffer like malefactors is hard. Nor can we lay our blood to the charge of the garrison, and the rest having used and treated us with all civility imaginable, we remain your most dutiful and dying friends.
Rosen didn't care for soldiers. He ignored their plea. However, word eventually got to King James himself, and James sent word for those that were driven beneath the walls to be allowed to return again to their homes. However, with every passing day, things grew worse within the city. Their meager provisions being exhausted, hunger spread through the city. Anything that could have been eaten was gladly seized. A dog was sold for 5 shillings and 6 pence. A rat, especially if it had been feasted on the corpse and blood, was looked upon as a great delicacy. A mouse was sold for 6 old pennies. And in those days, that was a considerable amount of money. We have a man here, and he got really worried during the siege. It wasn't that size because he had a secret stash of food. It was something to do with his make-up. But you know, he was so convinced that the people in the city were going to eat him that he actually went to the governor and he asked for the governor for an armed guard to protect him. Between the 8th and the 25th of July, the garrison alone was reduced mainly through starvation by 628 men. Sometimes we have this idea that there they were, all in the city, all united, all loyal, all prepared to stand and to die. But that wasn't the case. Hunger spreading through the city. Many were ready to surrender. On the 16th of May, a number of citizens went out to parley with King James. Mitchell Byrne commanded for a big gun to be brought and was fired into their midst. And they were blown into smithereens. There was hardly a day of the siege, but individuals were court-martialed for treason and for wanting to surrender or parley with the enemy. And yet all of that time, ships lay laden in Loch Foy, laden down with vital supplies of food and ammunition. Yet, week after week, they sat there, ignoring the desperate signals and cries from the city. Eventually, the Reverend James Gordon, minister of Glendermot Presbyterian Church, could stand it no more. And one night in the darkness of the night, he slipped over the walls of the city. He made his way through the lines of the enemy. He went down the banks of the Foy. He swam out to one of the ships. There he pleaded with Commander Major General Kirk to come to the relief of the city. Whether as a result of his pleas or as a result of new orders sent by King William in England, we don't know. But the order was given to relieve the city. It was no easy task. By because the enemy had only placed guns up each side of Loch Foyle, but they placed across the foyle a boom. It was made of logs held together by chains 12 inches thick. Despite this, the Dartmouth, the Mountjoy, captained by Captain Micaiah Browning, who was from the city, the Phoenix, the Jerusalem, began to make their way towards the city. The Dartmouth taking the lead, enemy guns opened up from Fort Culmore, bravely engaging the enemy. The Mountjoy and the Phoenix slipped by her. They made their way towards the boom. But just as they came to the boom, suddenly the wind calmed. The Mountjoy slowed. She hit the boom and she reverberated and she got stuck in shallow water. Immediately the cry rose from the camp of the Irish. They grabbed their guns and they ran to board the Mountjoy. But her captain, Captain Micaiah Browning, was not yet finished. He commanded all the guns on the land side to be fired at once. The reverberation drove her back out into open waters. God answering the prayers of his people, suddenly the wind began to blow. And this time it catching her snow-white sails, drove her up the foyle, drove her towards the boom. And this time it smashed in pieces. However, as the boom broke, there was a shot. And her brave captain, Captain Micaiah Browning, was hit and fell dead on the deck of his ship. He relieved the city, but he never saw that relief. Eventually, by 10 o'clock that evening, supplies were carried into the city. Food, ammunition were brought safely in. Realizing the city now could never be taken, James's forces began to retreat on the 1st of August. By their actions, the brave defenders not only saved the city of Derry, but you know, if that city had fallen, Ireland would have fallen. And Ireland has always been known as the back door to the English throne. I've no doubt if the city had fallen, Ireland would have fallen. And Ireland fallen, England would have fallen. James would have been back on the throne. And doing what he did best, he would have continued his persecutions. And he would have extinguished the light of the gospel. What a debt we owe tonight to those brave defenders who counted not their life precious, but stood. They were defending not merely a city. They were defending not merely a kingdom, but they were defending the truth of God. They knew if the city fell and James got the throne, again there would be persecution. Ministers would be turned out of their pulpits and the word of God would be suppressed. We should this evening remember them. We should thank God for their stand. The first commemoration of the siege took place in 1692. The Independent Mitchelburn Club was formed in 1775. The No Surrender Club was formed in 1814. It does us good just for a moment even to remember now the brave defenders of the city. Thank you. What a debt we owe to those men who for 105 days bravely defended the walls of the city. Like Lieutenant Colonel Blacker, we cry, long may the crimson banner wave, a meteor streaming airy, portentous oft the free and brave who manned the walls of Derry. And Derry's sons alike defy, Pope, traitor, or pretender, and peal to heaven their penitent cry, their patriot, no surrender. Let us never forget their actions, but let us seek to imitate them. Paul writing unto the Corinthians, he said, therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain. Compromise is not the language of Scripture, but rather the language of Satan. Buying the truth, we are not to sell it. You know, a man one day was watching a wee boy in a field with a horse, and he said to the wee boy, "My, is that a race horse?" He said, "Nope." He said, "Well, is it a plow horse?" He said, "No." He said, "Is it a show horse?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, does it run fast?" He said, "No, but it stands fast." And my friend, that's what God is looking for. He's looking for men and women and young people who know the truth of God and who stand fast, who know that the truth is not theirs to sell, but who will defend the truth, defend the doctrines of the Reformation, and seek to hand that truth to the generation that lies ahead. May God give us stickability. May God enable us to stand fast and to defend the faith and the liberty that we enjoy today. You know, on that Sabbath before the city was set free, the brave defenders, their faces black with hunger, their eyes dimmed with tears, their limbs weary, they made their way to the cathedral. They recognized that there was only a few days' provision left. And falling upon their knees, they cried unto God. And they cried that God would deliver their city. And you know, God heard their cry. He favored them with His presence. He set the city free. He favored them with His provision. He brought my supplies into the city. He favored them with His power. He broke the power of James upon the city. And you know, if you're here tonight and you're not saved, never been to the cross, could I say to you tonight, my, that your soul is besieged by an enemy that's great, an enemy that's terrible. Your soul is besieged by Satan himself, and he seeks your destruction. But if only, like the brave defenders, you recognize there's nothing you can do to deliver yourself, and you come and you cry unto God, my friend, as He delivered the city, He delivered your soul. As He provided for the city, He'll provide for your needs. He'll satisfy your soul. As He set the city free from the power of James, He'll set you free from the power of Satan. The habits that bound you, the habits that hold you, will be broken and broken forever. Oh, as He delivered the city, God is able and God is willing to deliver you tonight. If only you cry unto Him. Oh, cry tonight and know His mercy and know His forgiveness and His provision in your soul.